This episode of the Children's Literature Podcast is brought to you by Butter and Salt. Butter and Salt. How else do you think you're going to get your kids to eat green beans? Welcome to the Children's Literature Podcast. I'm your host, TQ Townsend. This episode is called Disease in Children's Literature. This is the second of a three-part series on tricky topics in children's literature. Last week, we discussed alcohol. Booze comes up more frequently than you'd think in children's literature. So my basic thesis was that it's good to have an idea of how to talk about it. In the case of older stories, you need to know how to frame the issue in its proper historical context. In response, listener Abigail wrote in to say, "I had never even thought about this before. I've read The Secret Garden 1,000 times, and I never stopped to think about when she drinks wine in Chapter 1, and she's only like 10 years old. I also never thought about how young Diana Barry is when she drinks wine in Anne of Green Gables. I always watched the old TV movies, so I thought of them as being teenagers." Thanks for those thoughts, Abigail. You're right about TV and film adaptations, which frequently cast teenage or even adult actors to play children's roles. Older actors can work longer hours with fewer restrictions, and it's hard to find kids who can act well. I've talked before how casting adults to play children has done wrong by the character of Amy March in adaptations of Little Women. In that 1985 TV version of Anne of Green Gables that so many of us grew up on, the actresses playing Diana and Anne were 15 and 17 years old. That makes the scene where Diana accidentally gets drunk feel very different than if the characters had been played by 11-year-olds. If any other listeners have thoughts about an episode, send me a message on Instagram at Children's Literature Podcast or write an email to letters@childrensliteraturepodcast.com. Just over 2 years ago, I would have said that modern children can have absolutely no idea of what diseases were like before modern medicine. But because of the COVID pandemic, unfortunately, they all understand the economic, social, and health costs of a proper plague. The astonishing thing is that things were much worse during the global influenza pandemic of 1918, or the many waves of bubonic plague that washed over Europe beginning in the 14th century, killing up to half the population. Disease in general is much less of a threat than it used to be. Kids today have no idea what an iron lung is. It's very rare to meet someone who is blind or deaf due to a childhood infection from measles or meningitis. You've probably heard of cholera, but can you explain what it is? Don't worry, by the end of this episode, you'll be able to. Modern sanitation, immunizations, and antibiotics mean that we hardly remember diseases that used to decimate communities. Before people knew what germs were, and developed sanitation to control them, and medicine to fight them, disease was a constant concern. If a child fell ill, families were mainly on their own. They could try home remedies or pay for a doctor and his expensive medicines, if they could afford it. More than 100 years ago, there sometimes wasn't much point to calling a doctor anyway. If it were a common infection without a cure, he'd only tell a family what they already knew, recommend the home remedies they were trying anyway, and send a bill they couldn't afford. Just in the books I've already covered in episodes of this podcast, disease comes up a lot. Little Lord Fauntleroy describes the debilitating effects of rheumatic fever, which keep a good father from being able to provide for his family. Disease also affects the wealthy, with the cranky old Earl of Dorincourt being afflicted with gout. The symptoms of starvation seen in a homeless girl on the streets of London are described in painful detail in A Little Princess. In The Secret Garden, a wealthy widower suffers pain from what was then called being a hunchback, though this is a term that's considered derogatory today. His son is in such poor general health that he spends most of his time lying in bed. He suffers frequently from coughs and colds, and at the age of only 10 has had both rheumatic fever and typhoid fever. The thing to notice about how disease is portrayed in books from more than about 100 years ago is that there's just an acceptance of illness as part of life. Nobody's amazed when a child falls ill, but they are terrified. Today, if a child is killed or left permanently harmed by a disease, it's incomprehensibly tragic. Back then, it was just tragic, not very incomprehensible. These different frames of reference are reflected in the literature of past and present. The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn was published in 1884, but set in the 1830s. This is well before anybody used the word germ to describe the tiny things that cause disease, and the idea of antibiotics would seem as realistic as a magic spell out of a fairy tale. The runaway slave Jim describes how his daughter Elizabeth went deaf after having scarlet fever. The child, as a slave, of course, received no care beyond what the family could provide. After she recovered, one day Jim grew angry when it seemed that Elizabeth was ignoring him repeatedly. He got so angry that he slapped her. Once Jim realizes that his daughter couldn't hear him, he feels horribly guilty. But he only feels awful about what he could have done differently. He never questions whether or not Elizabeth's illness could have ended differently. The deafness was just a consequence that he never could have had any power over. In contrast, we have The Mouse and the Motorcycle by Beverly Cleary. This book was published in 1965, after the development of germ theory, after the invention of antibiotics, and after the development of modern cold medicines that are pretty safe and effective. The story's climax comes when Keith, a very nice boy vacationing at an isolated mountain resort, becomes dangerously ill with a fever. His parents are unable to get any medicine for him because no shops are open and the nearest doctors are too far away. Ralph, a little mouse befriended by Keith, courageously searches for and delivers an aspirin tablet, which lowers the fever. Fevers used to kill kids all the time, but not by 1965, because aspirin existed. Ralph's entire character arc, in which he learns new skills, becomes more independent, and learns to be caring and useful toward others, wouldn't come to such a satisfying end if aspirin didn't exist. As a side note, today, doctors don't recommend aspirin for children, preferring first to try acetaminophen, also called paracetamol. If The Mouse and the Motorcycle had been written a century earlier, well, first it would have to be called The Mouse and the Steam Engine or something like that, and the story would have ended with Ralph sitting by Keith's bedside until either the fever broke or the child died. In books by modern authors, even often in historical fiction, characters show courage in the face of the disease by taking action against the illness itself, fighting to whatever end. In books by older authors, characters show strength through stoicism, acceptance, and endurance. It's not that the characters in older books don't try to do what they can to treat an illness. It's more that they're less likely to question how and why the disease happens at all. They take the fight against it less personally, and they're less shocked by poor outcomes. Modern characters expect a cure. Characters from the past are content with survival. These differences reflect the reality that the authors and readers have in their own time frame. Scenes from older novels can also tell us what medical treatments were standard at a moment in time. An important thing to remind children is that they should not try to take medicines described in old books. They're likely to be dangerously out of date. In Little Women by Louisa May Alcott, Beth March contracts scarlet fever after helping to care for the children of a very poor family in the neighborhood. When she comes home, her sister Jo finds her holding a bottle of camphor. Beth also reports that the doctor advised her to take belladonna. In the 19th century, bottled tinctures of opiated camphor, also called paregoric, contained a mixture of camphor, opium, honey, licorice, and any number of other ingredients. These medicines were commonly given to children to help with pain relief, coughing, and diarrhea. The doctor's advice to take belladonna, also known as deadly nightshade, was standard medical treatment at the time to try to protect patients from developing scarlet fever after they'd been exposed. This was gospel truth in 1860, but today we have better options than opium to treat a sore throat, and homeopathic tinctures of belladonna have been shown to be not just useless at fighting bacterial disease, but extremely risky, as belladonna is very toxic even at low doses. But these were the best tools available with the understanding doctors had at the time, so it's understandable that Beth attempts to save herself with opiated camphor and belladonna. A similar scene happens in Anne of Green Gables, which was published in 1908 but is set a few decades earlier. Anne is called upon to help a 3-year-old who is sick with croup. The parents of the Barry family are away, and the babysitter doesn't know what to do, so Diana Barry runs to Anne's house for help. Anne's foster father goes for the doctor, and Anne grabs a bottle of Ipecac and follows Diana back to the sick little girl. Croup is a viral upper respiratory infection that mostly affects little children. It gives kids a nasty barking cough and a fever. Unhelpfully, becoming agitated makes it worse, and if you've ever tried to keep a sick toddler calm, you know how pointless that can be. If the airways become too swollen, children with croup can be at risk of not getting enough oxygen. Today, steroids are used to open the airways if a child's in real trouble. Before that, Ipecac was used to help a child cough up excess phlegm, which would reduce the feeling of discomfort and anxiety. Ipecac is no longer used today because it's toxic, but it was the best tool Anne could have had, and because she'd been used by previous foster parents as unpaid childcare, she had a lot of experience in caring for babies with croup and dosing Ipecac correctly. She takes charge immediately. Anne went to work with skill and promptness. Minnie Mae has croup all right. She's pretty bad, but I've seen them worse. First, we must have lots of hot water. I declare, Diana, there isn't more than a cupful in the kettle. There, I've filled it up, and Mary Jo, you may put some wood in the stove. I don't want to hurt your feelings, but it seems to me you might have thought of this before if you'd had any imagination. Now, I'll undress Minnie Mae and put her to bed, and you try to find some soft flannel cloths, Diana. I'm going to give her a dose of Ipecac first of all. This all seems pretty sensible. Anne needs to get the little girl calm and breathing easier so she can rest. She gives medicine to loosen and expel congestion and asks for hot water and flannel cloths. I'm guessing this is to wash the child and clean up any messes, as Ipecac doesn't just act as an expectorant, but can also cause vomiting. One of the most sensible things Anne does is to get the little girl in her jammies and at least attempting to rest in bed. If the best treatment for croup is to get a child relaxed and resting, a nice warm bath and laying down in a quiet room is a great start. Anne's actions are exactly what you could do today to treat croup, with the exception of nixing the Ipecac. Little children usually aren't given cough medicines unless they're really in danger, and this should never be done without a physician's guidance. An article about this incident by Catherine Dicus in the Hectoan Journal of Medical Humanities makes a really great point about how Lucy Maud Montgomery wasn't just writing good drama. She was also arguing for the inclusion of women in medicine, which was an uphill battle in 1908. She writes, "The medical profession had long argued against female doctors, based on issues such as their greater emotional response to scenes of pain and suffering, and their sympathetic, and thus inherently weak, sensibilities. The American surgeon Edmund Andrews claimed in 1861 that, quote, "The primary requisite for a good surgeon is to be a man of courage," end quote. Anne, a true wordsmith, offers words of healing, encouragement, and reassurance. Not only does her behavior challenge Andrews' sentiment in terms of gender, but her courage appears even more striking for her young age. Furthermore, her sympathetic response for the patient is not a liability, as the male medical establishment suggested at the time, but a valuable asset. The last example I'll give today comes from The Secret Garden. In the opening chapter, Mary Lennox is a spoiled child living in a fancy bungalow in British colonial India when a cholera outbreak arrives. Her parents are killed and Mary is forgotten as the house descends into chaos. Mary alternately cried and slept through the hours. She only knew that people were ill and that she heard mysterious and frightening sounds. Once, she crept into the dining room and found it empty, though a partly finished meal was on the table, and the chairs and plates looked as if they had been hastily pushed back when the diners rose suddenly for some reason. The child ate some fruit and biscuits, and being thirsty, she drank a glass of wine which stood nearly filled. It was sweet, and she did not know how strong it was. Very soon it made her intensely drowsy, and she went back to her nursery and shut herself in again, frightened by the cries she heard in the huts and by the hurrying sound of feet. Cholera is a bacterial infection that spreads through contaminated water. It causes severe vomiting and diarrhea and can be fatal in up to half of those who fall ill if they don't receive prompt treatment for dehydration. Today, you don't have to worry about cholera if you live in a house that has pipes bringing clean water in and totally separate pipes carrying dirty water out. But it's still a problem in the developing world where clean drinking water and good sanitation are not guaranteed. The Secret Garden was published in 1911, when cholera was fairly well understood. Scientists had identified the bacterium that caused the disease and knew that hand washing, sanitary food and drink, and keeping drinking water sources separate from sewage was the right way to fight it. Burnett lived through several major cholera outbreaks, so she's able to describe its effects quite clearly. Rather than describing the disease itself, for which I'm grateful, she vividly describes the terror and confusion of an outbreak in a way that makes the first chapters of the book seem more like a horror novel than a heartwarming tale about gardening. Burnett understood enough about cholera to leave clues as to why Mary isn't infected. First, she's completely isolated from other people. After Mary's nursemaid and parents die and many others fall ill, the child is left completely alone in her nursery. Ironically, this act of neglect helps to save Mary, keeping her physically away from anyone who might infect her. Also, when she does eat and drink, she chooses fruit and biscuits, meaning dry, crumbly cookies, items that are not likely to be contaminated with cholera. She also drinks wine. I mentioned this incident in the last episode on alcohol in children's literature. It used to be common for children to be given a little wine, usually weakened with water, at special occasions or when they were unwell. Today, this is getting more rare as we know how harmful alcohol is to children, and it's often illegal to give it to them anyway. However, as awkward as this is for me to admit, it was good that Mary washed down her fruit and cookies with a bunch of wine, because the alcohol would have killed any cholera in her meal. If she'd had a glass of water, it might have killed her. You don't need to tell your kids this, though, because you don't need to hear a teenager say one day, "So, if there's a cholera outbreak, then I should get drunk, because it'll save my life." For an activity that will help students better understand the physical and social impact of diseases in the past, I've made a research worksheet that you can print out. It can be used with any work of children's fiction in which a character becomes ill. There's spaces for the student to note what year the book was published, what type of sickness is in the story, and what treatments were recommended in the past in comparison to today. More advanced students could use this as the first step of a larger research project. Disease used to be depicted more bluntly and in a more matter-of-fact fashion than it is in more modern works of literature, but one thing that hasn't changed is that sickness can be used to set a protagonist on a new journey, force characters to make tough choices, or act as a crucible for burning away bad personal traits. There can be differences in how disease is experienced by modern and older authors and readers. But one thing that's the same for everyone is that illness is part of our lives, even children's lives. It is a tricky topic, but by including pain and sickness in stories, authors can help young readers develop empathy and realize that life is valuable because it's fragile and temporary. Depictions of diseases from the past in fiction can be horrifyingly blunt, by modern standards, but with the right framing, it won't scare children, but rather help them appreciate just how far we've come in protecting their health and lives. You've been listening to the Children's Literature Podcast. Please subscribe to the show and leave a rating. Send comments to letters@childrensliteraturepodcast.com. I'm your host, TQ Townsend. Thanks for listening.